We're looking at John's Gospel, which is one of the four accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection that we have in the New Testament. And over the last few weeks, we've been looking at the controversy surrounding one of Jesus' miracles, because it happened on a Sabbath in Jerusalem. Okay, but now, beginning in chapter 6, if you notice, Jesus is on the move, verse 1. After this, after all of the debate, after all of the argument, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Okay, but what becomes obvious is that if Jesus' miracles were controversial to some people, like the religious leaders, these miracles were clearly attractive to others. Verse 2. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. And that crowd, it really sets the stage for the one miracle outside of the resurrection that is recorded in all four of the Gospels. And that should give you pause. Because if Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all thought that what follows matters, then it clearly matters, doesn't it? Okay, not just to them. What they're saying is this matters to us. And the question is why? Well, we're going to look at Jesus' follow-up teaching to this next week. But today, from this passage, I want you to see three things about Jesus. Okay, firstly, he is Christ the questioner. Secondly, he is Christ the provider. And thirdly, he is Christ the king. Okay, firstly then, Christ the questioner. Now, if you haven't noticed, we live in a time when crowd sizes have become strangely controversial. Okay, but they were here too. At least there is debate over how big this crowd would have been. Because in verse 10, John says, "So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number." Okay, that's just the men. Okay, is it just a men's outing? Probably not. So if you add the women and the children, people say this crowd could have been anywhere up to 20,000. And in his commentary on this, on John's Gospel actually, John Calvin, the great reformer, he makes the point that this crowd, was not what Jesus came away for. Because what the other Gospels make clear is that in coming out to the hill country, or as John calls it, verse 3, up on the mountain, it's the Golan Heights, in coming out, Jesus was wanting a quiet spot. He's wanting to escape from the crowds. He's wanting to escape from the controversy in Jerusalem, and he wants to spend some time alone with his disciples. But what does he get? He gets a crowd the size of a town. And if it was somewhere between, I don't know, 15 and 20,000, that's the size of Morges. That's like the entire population of Morges coming out wanting to spend time with Jesus. Okay, what are you like when things are not going the way you want them to go? Okay, or you're not getting what you want, or you know, you've got these plans for how you want to spend your day or spend your holiday and somebody else torpedoes them. And you've got this idea of how things are going to go and somebody else is wrecking that. How do you respond to that? He says, Calvin points out, Jesus wanted quiet and his father sends him a crowd. And yet, there's no hint of resentment, is there? There's no hint of frustration in Jesus' response. Verse 5, lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Okay, he is not wrapped up in his own needs, is he? Rather than being wrapped up in his own wants, Jesus sees their need and he moves to meet it. And in his gospel, Mark tells us why. What it is Jesus is seeing. He had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so Jesus steps in to be their shepherd. Okay, but how does he do it? Did you see how he does it? He does it by asking Philip a question. hey, Philip, where are we going to get bread to feed them all? Where are we going to buy bread for them all? Now, do some of you remember the terror of oral examinations? Okay, I don't mean going to the dentist. I mean, you are sat, some of you have had them recently, okay? End of gymnasium, maybe even at uni, and you are sat eyeball to eyeball with your examiner. Well, do you remember what it was like? Maybe you're living through this now, okay? Being sat in a classroom and the lecturer is firing off questions and you are dreading being next in line. Philip is that man. Okay, so why does Jesus pick on him? Because he's got 12, hasn't he? I mean, is Philip the guy at the back falling to sleep, you know, nodding off? You know, Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God, and, you know, Philip is sort of, you know, feeling a bit tired, and Jesus fires a question at him to wake him up. Is that what's going on? Okay, no. Okay, John has told us back in chapter 1 that Philip was from Bethsaida, which is in this region. Okay, Philip's a local boy. He's from around these parts. Okay, so this is like Jesus saying, hey, Phil, you're from around here. Where's the best boulangerie? Okay, except it's more than that, isn't it? Because in verse 6, John says, he said this to test him, and it is not a test of his local knowledge. See, John tells us again, verse 6, that he himself, Jesus, already knew what he would do. Okay, so if the disruption of our plans or of our wants, what we want, if the disruption of those things asks questions of us, so too can situations that seem hopeless. Because this is a test of what is going on in Philip's heart when he is faced with a need that is beyond himself. What is going on in Philip's heart when he faces circumstances or a situation that he just can't solve by himself, that are beyond him, that just feel too deep or too troublesome for him to bring resolution to? So if you think about it, if it is a test for Philip, it's a test for all of them, but it's a test for all of us too. Because if this is a one question examination paper, John has already given us a clue to the answer that Jesus is looking for. Verse 4. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Again, what did Passover celebrate? What's going on in their minds at this moment? It's like Advent, building up to Christmas. Well, they're building up to Passover. So what is going on in their minds? How God had delivered Israel from slavery in Egypt and sustained them in the desert with what? With manna, with bread. Okay, so I don't think this is too outlandish. What was the answer Jesus was looking for? Was something like, where are we to buy bread to feed them all? Nowhere. There's not a boulangerie within a million miles of here that can meet this need. But Jesus, it's Passover. And in the desert, God fed a far greater crowd. So Jesus, we can trust him. In fact, Jesus, we can trust you to do it again. Okay, if that's maybe what Jesus was looking for, what's the answer that Philip gives? Oh, how would you have responded? What answer would you have given? This crowd, the size of Morge, walking towards you. And Jesus is asking you, how are you going to feed them? Verse 7, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. In other words, feed that number of people, Jesus? It had cost a fortune. I mean, even if there was a boulangerie that would take our order, we couldn't possibly pay for it. And even if we did have that much money, they'd only get a scrap each. So what happens next? Andrew comes to his rescue. Okay, but does he do any better? Verse 8. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to Jesus, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many? It's interesting, isn't it? I think particularly for people like us, okay, they are thinking in terms of logistics. They're thinking in terms of scale and finance. They are thinking in terms of supply and demand, aren't they? They are thinking humanly. Okay, they are thinking in terms of best business practice. They're thinking with a business mindset of what's humanly possible. They are thinking in terms of the market. And their conclusion is, hey, we can't do this. This is way too big. We cannot do this. You see, the difficulties we face in life ask questions of us, don't they? Not just of them, but of us as well. In fact, through the difficulties of life, God is asking us questions like, when you're not getting what you want, what does your response to that tell you about what your heart is wrapped up in, about what's most important to you? Or when you're faced with a situation that seems hopeless, that you are powerless to change, or when your inability or lack or your deficiencies are being brought home to you hard, to what or to whom are you looking? What are you trusting in? What are you hoping in? The difficulties of our life, through those difficulties, God asks questions of our hearts. But if you think about it, Philip and Andrew are right, aren't they? I mean, this is an inconvenience, having moors arriving on your doorstep to your personal picnic, and they don't have enough money, and these rolls and these fish are not enough. They're right, but they're only partially right, because they have left Christ out of the equation. Second point then, Christ the provider. If he's the questioner, he's also the provider. Verse 10, Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now, if you are tempted to think, I mean, whether you're not yet a Christian or maybe if you are a Christian, if you're tempted to think that what follows is the stuff of fairy tales, just look at what John adds. Now, there was much grass in that place. Okay, that is one of those unnecessary eyewitness details that you find in the Gospels that tell you this is not made up, and John was really there. He can picture the scene that as they sit down, this grass is waist high. Because it's Passover, it's springtime, and the grass has not yet been frazzled by the sun. But then, verse 11, Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. Okay, so Philip's 200 denarii, 7 months of salary, would have given them a scrap. But from 5 barley loaves, the bread of the poor, and 2 fish, Jesus gives them a feast. And so what God did in the desert with Israel, Jesus does in the field with this crowd. Okay, but maybe you still think that's fanciful. And that is an issue that C.S. Lewis, professor at Oxford when he was, before he moved to the better place, Cambridge, okay, that is a question that Lewis addresses in his book, Miracles. And he would ask you, why do you think this is fanciful when God does something similar every year at harvest? And he uses the same argument that Augustine used when he preached on this passage, 1,600 years ago, that every grain of seed a farmer plants is just such a miracle. It's just on a small scale. Because from a few grains of seed comes a field of wheat to feed a town. So do you really think that God, who made everything, who multiplies a handful of seed into a crop, do you think that God cannot multiply a few loaves into a feast? And when he does, he's not stingy, is he? I don't know what influence you have on your friends, but one of our friends in the UK says that I have had an influence on her husband. And it's not for good, okay? She says that he used to be really generous, that he used to be carefree with his money, that he was always happy to spend it on her and the family until he met me. And now, she says, he's always looking to cut costs and to save money and to turn down the heating and to buy things on Temu. And she says, Martin, you have made him stingy. Okay, no one could accuse Jesus of being stingy, could they? Because it's not just that everyone had as much as they wanted, it's that Jesus supplies more than anyone could possibly want. And he tells the disciples to go and collect up the leftovers. In verse 13, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments. Okay, so as one theologian puts it, after all have been satisfied, there is more left over than there was at the beginning. That is not stingy. What is it? It's lavish. Christ is a lavish provider. And if in the desert God fed the 12 tribes, and here Christ feeds a multitude and 12 baskets full are left over, the message is clear, isn't it? Christ has enough. He has enough, more than enough, to feed all the people of God, that he is the one who can fully and finally satisfy your hunger, a hunger deeper than just physical hunger. So if I were to ask you, have you ever eaten in McDonald's? Okay, 90% of you would probably confess and admit it, and the other 10% of you would lie, okay? But there have been times when Sue and I have thought, oh, let's just go and get a McDonald's. And we've given in to that temptation. And as we have staggered back to the car, we have felt sick. And we have, why did we do that? I mean, why do you fall for it every time? Okay, there are some meals that can leave you feeling worse off than before. Okay, but there are also some meals that leave you feeling hungry and unsatisfied. And you come to them and you think, man, I could do with a bit more. Okay, what if Jesus providing this feast is not just telling you that he has power to meet their physical hunger and your physical needs? What if this is telling you that he has the power to meet your inner spiritual heart hunger? In a way that does not leave you feeling sick, and in a way that leaves you feeling satisfied. Because if Jesus, when he teaches us to pray, he says, pray, our Father in heaven, give us today our daily bread. He's teaching us, look to God for your physical needs. Okay, look to God with expectant and thankful hearts for your daily physical needs. Okay, that is true. And yet, when he is being tempted in the wilderness by Satan to make his physical needs, to make his hunger, his physical needs, the most important, the most pressing thing in his life at this moment, what does he do? He quotes back scripture saying, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God, which means there is a hunger that bread cannot answer. There's a hole inside us that bread cannot fill, that having our physical needs cannot meet, and that to really live is not to have all your needs, let alone your wants, met. Okay, whatever the advertising industry tells you, okay, because the advertising industry tells you, hey, have your physical needs met and your life will be great. You know, buy this new car, use this hair product if you have it, take out this hair insurance. That's a great way to save money, guys, actually, I would just say. If you want to save money, shave your head. Okay, buy this new car, have this hair product, take out this health insurance, and this is what the adverts tell you. Buy this new car, you're going to have the perfect family with 4 blonde kids. Use this hair product and you're going to have men turning their heads at you every time you walk past. And in the case of health insurance, one advert that is running at the moment tells you, you take out this health insurance, you will have a beautiful and pregnant wife whose abdomen you can stroke. You've just got to change your provider. Really? Seriously? What are they telling you? Okay, meet your physical needs and your life will be full. But as Paul Tripp, the American pastor and author, says, ultimately life is about what we look to fill us. So what do you look to? What are you looking to? What are you looking to for satisfaction in life? What are you looking to for that feeling, that sense that life is good and you are full? Maybe you're looking for it in a soulmate. You think, if I can just find him or her, life will be good. Maybe you think it's in traveling and seeing the world, or in creating the perfect family and the perfect home, or maybe it's in your career. Okay, whatever it is, if Ozempic is the new wonder drug, okay, mimicking your body's signal that you are full, what can do that for your heart? Because there's no drug that can do it, is there? There's no drug, there's no travel, there's no career, there are no possessions, there are no relationships that can ever do that. Or if there was, why do we have to go on searching for the next thing? Why do you have to change health insurance provider if that one didn't do it? Why do you have to get a new car if that one didn't do it? Why do you have to change job if that dream job hasn't answered that hole in your heart? But through this miracle, Jesus is saying, but I can. I can do it. I can fill your heart. You see, you can go to the banquet table of relationships or possessions or leisure or travel or reputation, and it may fill you for a bit. Or like a McDonald's, frankly, it may leave you feeling sick. Or, Jesus says, you can come to him and be satisfied. Of course, what many of us do is we sort of run between the two tables, don't we? We think, yeah, I can have the best of both worlds. I can have a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of this and a bit of that. And we end up with the worst of both worlds. As I was saying to somebody this week, you know, you've got too much of God to enjoy your sin, and you've got too much sin to enjoy God. We end up happy in neither. Because if Jesus questions Philip through Isaiah, as we did in our reading, God questions all of us. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and you labor for that which does not satisfy? Instead, as you see this crowd lying back in the long grass, full, and as you watch the disciples filling up their baskets, Jesus is saying, it is me who can satisfy you. Now the danger is that you come to him for what you can get and not for him. Okay, one of the things we love about Switzerland are the 24-hour cheese dispensers out in the village. I mean, what other country? I mean, other countries have Coke and crisp dispensers. Switzerland has cheese. Okay, don't have enough fondue, don't worry about it. You just need to go down to the fromage mat, stick your coins in the slot, and you are sorted. And the danger is we treat Jesus like a fromage mat, don't we? I mean, you know, we can see Jesus meeting needs and think, okay, I will come to him. I'll come to him for a better marriage. I'll come to him because I want to become a better person. I come to him because I want a better job. Or I want to come to him so I can find a pretty girl or a hunky husband. And I will stick in my spiritual coins and he will give me what I want. Okay, what the rest of the passage tells us, guys, we cannot treat Christ like that. We cannot treat him like that. That we are to come to him for him, not for what we can get. That it's him who will satisfy us, not the things he gives us. Okay, last point then, Christ the King. Christ who questions us, Christ who provides, and Christ the King. Verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." And when the people of Israel were still being fed with manna in the desert, Moses says to them, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you. It is to him you shall listen." Okay, so this crowd is seeing Jesus doing in the field what Moses did in the desert, providing them with food. And Jesus speaking to them God's word in a way that no one, not even Moses, has done. And they are thinking, he's got to be the prophet. He's got to be the prophet that Moses foretold. He's got to be Moses Mark 2. But remember, it's also Passover. Okay, what are they thinking about at Passover? The celebration of God leading his people out into freedom. So it's not just the grass that's growing high. So are their feelings, so is their nationalistic zeal, because if ancient Israel was enslaved by Egypt, they are enslaved by Rome. And if Jesus is Moses Mark 2, then surely, just like Moses, Jesus can lead them to freedom. You see, when Jesus saw them as sheep without a shepherd, he's alluding to a prophecy made hundreds of years before that Ahab, king of Israel, would be killed in a battle. And as a result, the prophet who sees this coming said, "I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd." So Jesus is not looking at them thinking they're a flock without a shepherd, they're a church without a pastor. He is thinking they're an army without a general. They're a people without a king. But now in Jesus, they have found one, and they intend to make him one by force. Because it's whether it's their physical hunger or the physical oppression they're experiencing under Rome, they think that it's those needs being met that's the way to life. Okay, so how does Jesus respond? Verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. And as he withdraws, the disciples also leave. Verse 16. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. Okay, you probably know what that feels like, don't you? I know for some of us in our church family, some of us have lost a parent, loved parent this week. Some of us are seeing our a parent suffering real harm back in their home country. Others of us have got issues in our workplaces. Okay, you know what this feels like. Because it's not just those times when you're not getting what you want and you're experiencing the lack of something that asks questions of you. It's those times when we face the presence of things, things that we don't want, things that we wish we weren't having to experience, the presence of things in our lives, when we things we dearly wish were absent. You're like coming face to face with our mortality or difficulties in our relationships at work or health or financial issues. And life can feel as rough as the sea, and the wind is strong and stuff is being thrown in your face, and it feels like you are trying to row through a storm. And where is God? He can feel strangely absent, can't he? And Jesus had not yet come to them, John says. Okay, but then he does come. Verse 19. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. And the Daily Telegraph, it's a UK newspaper this week, there is an article entitled, "Awe is our most mysterious emotion and could hold the key to the meaning of life." Okay, it's a great article, actually. It comes to a totally wrong conclusion, but it's a great article. And in it, the author describes how we feel awe looking at and experiencing the power of the natural world. But he says we have become acclimatized to it, and combining that with our loss of the sense of transcendence, the author says that we try and manufacture it. We try and manufacture awe in ways that mean that we can experience the danger of nature but still survive. And he gives the example of whitewater rafting. Okay, well, here is Jesus, and he is walking on the whitewater. And it's not a river, it is the sea. And he's not struggling against the elements like the disciples in the boat who are pulling on the oars with all their strength. He is walking. They are pulling. And Jesus is walking. And when they see him, they're frightened. They're awestruck, not by the power of the natural world, but by the one who can tread it underfoot. You see, to the ancients, the sea was a place of chaos. It's a place of deep darkness, seething under the surface, ready to break out. It's the place, it's the lair of Leviathan, the untamable monster. And here is Jesus, and what is he doing? He's walking over it. He's walking over the darkness. He's walking over the chaos. He's walking over the threat. He's treading it all underfoot like a walk in the park. And at the first Passover, God divided the Red Sea so the people could walk across as on dry ground. And here is Jesus walking on the water as on dry ground. No wonder they're afraid. But how does he calm their fear? Verse 20, he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat. Now when he says, "It is I," it's literally ego eimi, I am. Okay, that can be used, it's used elsewhere in the New Testament, even just as a normal way for somebody to introduce themselves. Hey, it's me. Okay, but it was also the way that God first announced himself to Moses at the burning bush. And as we're going to see next week, the I am sayings of Jesus begin. And God appears to Moses and says, "I am who I am. I am the only self-existent one. I am the only self-sufficient one. I am the only one from whom everyone and everything takes its existence, including this surging sea." He's the only one who can satisfy your deepest needs and calm your deepest fears. You see, the crowd were not wrong, were they? Is Jesus the prophet like Moses who was to come? Is he the shepherd king come in the line of David? Absolutely. But he is far, far more. He is the one who sent the prophets. He's the one whose spirit inspired the prophets. He's the one whose words the prophets spoke. He's the one whose coming the prophets foretold. And is he the king? Yes, he is. He is the king over every king. He's the king over storms. He's the king over chaos. He is the king over hunger. And he is the king over lack. But he will not claim his throne by force or conquer Rome by sword or spear. Instead, he will come under the sword of Rome's justice, and at the cross he will receive in his side the wound of the spear. Because it's not just bread this king gives. This king gives himself. And he went hungry so that we might be filled. He thirsted so that our thirst might be quenched. He walked through the far greater storm and darkness of God's wrath so that you and I need never fear. See, to paraphrase C.S. Lewis, it's not that the crowd's desire for bread or for a king were too big. It's that their desire was too small. And if you come to Christ for what he can give you, you are aiming much too low, because it is himself that he gives. So come to him. Come, feed at his table, be satisfied. Let him fill you. Invite him into the chaos and the dark places of your life, and let him give you his peace. It is I. Do not be afraid. Let's pray.